So we're going to start tonight looking at Christianity in that Roman Empire around the year 500, because we left off with kind of the end of the early church fathers in the West, Augustine, Leo, and other figures like that who were in the 400s AD, the mid-5th century. So I'm going to share my screen here. Oh, yeah, I see your question there. Extra credit if we buy the book. Well, I'll have to think about that, James. Maybe if you buy the book and write a nice review for me on Amazon. let me share my screen here. Okay. Now, hold on just a second. It's going to take me a second to get this set. I have a map here. Since we're going to be moving out of the Mediterranean basin, and you know, sometimes it's helpful to have our geography in our heads. So I'm going to share this map with you here. Does everyone see that? Okay, so this is a map of the Mediterranean basin and Persia there you see on the right as well, in the 6th century, so in the 500s AD. And you'll notice some things right off the bat, and that is that a lot of what used to be the Roman Empire over here in the West, France, Spain, some parts of Italy, is vanishing into other things. What you're left with is this piece over here, which we call the Byzantine Empire. Byzantine Empire is really nothing more than just the Eastern Roman Empire. It didn't actually have a change in government or anything like that. It is the Roman Empire that was transplanted to a new capital at Constantinople. So it, you know, we call it Byzantine because it shifted location, because it developed its own kind of culture after this time. But just so you know, there's no actual break between the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. The one flows straight into the other. In fact, the Byzantines called themselves Romans right up until the end in the 1400s. They viewed themselves as the Roman Empire because in large degree that's what they were. What we're going to start talking about here is the development of Eastern Orthodoxy. Now, Eastern Orthodoxy is one of the two largest communions of Christians in the world today. The biggest Christian, or the biggest communion that would call itself Christian, is the Roman Catholic Church, and the biggest by a large measure. But the next biggest is what we call Eastern Orthodoxy, and that's a group of churches that outwardly they look somewhat similar to Roman Catholic churches and so on, but there are important differences in certain elements of doctrine and practice. And they have, it's a union of Greek Orthodox Church, a lot of these churches in the Balkans, the Romanian Orthodox Church, Serbian Orthodox Church. The biggest one is the Russian Orthodox Church. Ukraine has a couple different Orthodox communions right now, which is actually part of the tension between Russia and Ukraine right now is based on some of these Orthodox communion issues, but that's a whole different story. It's during this time that Eastern Orthodoxy starts to take shape, but we've got to remember that it's actually still in full communion with the Western Church right up until the 11th century. So there's been no formal break between the two. They still view each other as being one in the same church. But in terms of the theological cultures they're developing, the Roman Catholic Church is starting to go its own way. We looked at that a little bit at the end of the session last week. And the Eastern Orthodox Church is starting to develop in its own direction in terms of some culture. So essentially what you have here is the Byzantine Empire becomes sort of the basis for developments in what will later become Eastern Orthodoxy. Over here on this side, Rome and these western provinces become the center of what's going to develop into the Roman Catholic Church. But it's still all together in one piece. I find the Byzantine Empire really fascinating. It was a Christian empire from beginning to end. By the time we start calling it the Byzantine Empire, all of its emperors are Christians because of, you know, the conversion of Constantine that we talked about last time. And once you get to the 500s, where we are tonight, all of the emperors are Christians of one sort or another. And that carries on all the way through. They actually have a fantastically long history. The Byzantine Empire survives. They lose a lot of territory along the way, but they survive until 1453. So you have, even after Rome and the western provinces are mostly lost, the Byzantine Empire goes for a good 1,000 years, which is just staggering, right? I mean, the U.S., we're just coming up on a quarter of a millennium here in a couple of years. The Byzantine Empire went for 1,000 years, and that's not even including the life of the Roman Empire before it, right? So, anyway, a really remarkable Christian civilization, but it had lots of ups and downs, lots of flaws as well. So that's what's going on here with the Byzantine side of things. On the Western side of things here, you know, we talk about the fall of Rome. You might have studied this in history classes in high school and college. Is that around this time, it's usually marked in the 400s, I think 476 AD. They talk about the fall of Rome. And what they mean by that is that the Western Roman Empire ceases to exist as the Roman Empire. But you get these other Germanic people groups who are moving in. Visigoths are one of the first ones, come down and sack Rome in the year 410, and then they press on and end up here in Spain. Then Ostrogoths, which aren't mentioned on this map, but they're another group. Ostrogoths and Lombards move in. Both of these are Germanic-speaking people groups, which used to be regarded as barbarians by the Romans, and they basically take over the administration of the Western Empire. The interesting thing, though, is that if you went back and talked to any of them, they would not have noted 476 AD as a transition of anything significant. They didn't think of it as the fall of Rome. Romans didn't think of it as the fall of Rome. It was kind of a natural progression of political developments that had been going on there for a couple hundred years. Most of these so-called barbarian kingdoms were actually pretty heavily Romanized by the time they came down and entered Italy. They sort of wanted to be Roman, and they took a lot of the culture of the Roman Empire upon themselves. So rather than thinking of it as the fall of Rome, even though the Roman Empire proper did kind of cease to exist in that part, all of them really would have still talked and thought about themselves as successors of Rome. They didn't see it as a new thing coming in. They just saw it as sort of a change in administration, if you will. What we've got, okay, so that's kind of the basic political picture we've got going on. Now I'm going to focus on some of what's happening here in Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. By the 500s, you get a pretty powerful figure arising in the Emperor Justinian. Christian emperor, like all the others, but when we call him a Christian emperor, he's a Christian, but he's also an emperor. And emperors in the ancient world always kind of acted like thugs, and that was still a little bit of the way Justinian acted in some of his political maneuverings. But what he did was he brought a lot of stability back to the empire. He actually reconquered a whole bunch of pieces of the Western Empire. That's the green you see over here. This was actually sort of rare in the history after the turn of the mid-millennium. Most of this most of this green in Italy, in North Africa, in Spain, that would have been gone. Aside from a brief reconquest under Justinian, that wasn't really part of the Byzantine Empire anymore. But he succeeded in stabilizing things, and it's under him that this identity, this cultural identity of Byzantium, which is just an alternate name for the city of Constantinople, this identity for Byzantium and its civilization develops in the combination of Roman law, because they're still Roman, and Christian religion and Greek philosophy. They're next to Greece here now. So Greek philosophy plays a big role in Byzantine culture. And in fact, they stop speaking Latin and start speaking Greek in the administration of imperial affairs. One of the things Justinian is most known for, and your textbook mentions this as well, is the construction of the great cathedral in Constantinople, Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom. It replaced an earlier version of the same church that had been on that spot, Hagia Sophia. But his construction was just incredible in terms of its architecture, not only for its own day, but really even for our day. I've been able to travel a lot of different places, but I haven't gotten to Istanbul, now the name of Constantinople. But the Church of Hagia Sophia is one that I would love to see. Not a church anymore, unfortunately, since the Turks took over, it's alternated between being a mosque and a museum, but it would still be pretty amazing to see it. It has the largest freestanding dome in the ancient world by a long shot. And in Byzantine times, it was just covered by these beautiful gold leaf icons all over the inside. So it's sort of designed to make you feel like you're stepping into heaven, essentially. The story is told that when Justinian finally was able to step into the completed cathedral of Hagia Sophia, he was so awestruck by this accomplishment. I mean, he didn't actually build it; it was the architects he hired. But he was so awestruck by the accomplishment and so proud of himself that he's said to have said, "Solomon, I have surpassed thee." Essentially saying Hagia Sophia is even more splendid than the great temple of Israel in the Old Testament. After Justinian and some of the emperors that followed, the Byzantine Empire had a rough time, especially during the 7th century. So we're in the 600s AD now. And the reason why it had a tough time was because not only had it lost most of its western territories, but over here you've got the other great world power, the Sassanid Empire, the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was a thorn in the side of the Romans from all the way back in like Julius Caesar's time, constantly butting heads here along the borderlands in Mesopotamia and in the Caucasus Mountains. Rome never successfully conquered Persia, and it persisted. And during this time period, it really gained in power. So you have, almost like the Cold War in the 20th century, you have two major world powers that are just always ready for war along this tense borderline. And they're pretty evenly weighted against each other. During the reign of an emperor named Heraclius, you have kind of a back and forth series of invasions between the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire. And both of them just, they like take turns devastating each other's territories. So, in the Persian Empire's invasion, they're actually able to conquer all the way down through here, seize all of this Palestinian territory, press on deep into what's now Turkey. In fact, if you visit Israel, one of the things you'll notice is that there, even though Christians had been building churches in Israel since, the 300s at least, the time of Constantine, it's really hard to find any churches that are earlier than the late 600s. And the reason for that is the Persians basically destroyed all the Christian churches they found in Palestine when they conquered it in the early 600s. The one church, interesting trivia fact, the one church that they didn't destroy was the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And so if you go to that church, you'll see there's still remnants. It's kind of been done over a number of times during the years. So most of what we have now is from the time of Justinian, but some of it goes back to the time of Constantine. The reason why the Persians left that church alone is because there used to be this big fresco mural on the outside of the Magi, the wise men. And it showed them garbed in Persian garb. And so the Persian invaders see this church with, oh, hey, you've got a giant painting of us on the side, these us Persians, so we'll leave that church alone. So that's the one church you can see that still predates the Persian invasion. You have, after that, Heraclius launches a response, and he, leading the Byzantine army, is able to press deep into the Sassanid Empire, the Persian Empire, and they go back and forth over the course of a couple decades, just hammering each other, and until they reach this state of exhaustion, where you have plagues coming in on both sides, devastating the area. You have these two massive armies that have fought each other to a standstill, and their numbers are drastically reduced. But if you think, okay, Matt, this is interesting politics of the 7th century. Why is it important in church history? The reason why it's important is because this is where that other big world religion steps in, and that's Islam, right? And it's important to understand because Christianity is going to be interacting with Islam a lot in the story of church history. It's important to understand the context of how Islam arose. One of the remarkable things about Islam's rise in the 7th century is how this group of kind of backwater rural nobodies, as they were seen at the time, managed to conquer an entire world empire over here and carve off huge chunks of the other great world empire over here in rapid succession, really fast. Now, Islamic apologists would say, well, that's a sign that Allah was with us, that Allah blessed the early Islamic wars. But historically speaking, it's not actually. I would say that you can't really point to divine intervention very clearly in that story. What I see as a student of history is that you had, because of these massive wars between the Byzantine Empire and the Sassanid Empire, you had this incredible power vacuum that suddenly developed right here in the middle where the Arabs were. The Arabs weren't just down here on the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the strongest Arab coalitions were actually up here on the borderlands, Mesopotamia, what's now Syria and Jordan. You had some very powerful client states that had fought for the Byzantines and the Persians as kind of mercenary armies off and on. But when Byzantium and the Sassanids really kind of collapsed in exhaustion, those guys were the ones left standing. And it just happened to coincide with this new religious movement that was coming up out of the desert. And so they had both the opportunity to just kind of step into the power vacuum. There weren't many significant battles that happened during the Islamic takeover. And that's largely because there weren't any armies left to fight them. Islamic history will talk a little bit about a great battle they pitched against the Byzantines, but the early historical sources for Islam are questionable to say the least. We don't need to get into that tonight, but there's an ongoing scholarly debate about the origins of Islam and how much of the traditional story of Islam's takeover was accurate or possibly was more a product of the propaganda arm of the Abbasid Caliphate 200 years later. So anyway, Don't need to get into that. But all that to say, the Arabs were able to step into this power vacuum with the exhausted armies on either side, and so they kind of took over and built their own empire, the first major version of which was called the Umayyad Caliphate, and it was centered with a capital in Damascus here in Syria. And they also they conquered completely the Persian Empire, so the Persian Empire went out of existence. Byzantine Empire did not. The Muslims were also able to take Egypt here pretty easily. And if you remember, Egypt was a pretty thoroughly Christian place. The churches there had split from the Constantinople church over the issues we talked about last time, the nature of Christ. But they still had a lot of passionate Christian adherents. And this is where you get the Coptic church. The native Christians in Egypt are called the Copts. And even today, you know, after 1,500 years of Muslim rule, there's still a very significant minority population in Egypt. The church-going population in Egypt is as high, possibly higher, than the church-going population in Great Britain right now. So you shouldn't get the sense that Islam just wiped out Christians in Egypt. They've been there all along, although they did suffer something of a decline. So all this is happening during the reign of Emperor Heraclius. The Byzantine Empire is contracting. The Copts in Egypt fall under Muslim rule. They're not wild about that, but they're also kind of okay with it at the beginning because they weren't big fans of Constantinople either. So you just change one master, you're not wild about for another one, really. At the same time that this was going on, you also had other major developments in Christian theology. And one of the interesting things about the rise of Islam is that it wasn't thought to be another major world religion when it popped up. We can go back and read in the early Christian sources, and what you might expect to find is to have Christians saying, "Whoa, what's this weird new religion that's coming out of Arabia? This is something entirely new." You don't have that. In fact, Islam is consistently interpreted as a Christian heresy for the first couple hundred years. Because if you ever happen to look at the Quran and read it, one of the things you'll find is that actually the most compelling and frequent character talked about in the Quran is Jesus. Jesus pops up all through the Quran, and he's saying heretical things, talking about how, you know, he's not actually one with the Father, the Trinity is a false idea, all these kinds of things. But a good bunch of it is actually about Jesus. And so when Muslims first came on the scene, early Christians didn't react to them as a new world religion. They kind of reacted to them as another Christological heresy. And they've seen all kinds of those before. I think they probably kind of expected and hoped that it would peter out like some of the other ones had before it. But you had other theological work going on at the same time, and one of the big names there is Maximus the Confessor, who I know on your study sheet. Maximus the Confessor, he's also in the 7th century, and the final Christological debates. One of the things that was going on here in the Eastern Empire was that the emperor, and Heraclius was a big part of this, other emperors as well, the emperor was still trying to use Christian doctrine to keep his empire together as much as he could. And remember, Egypt has kind of broken off already religiously, even though it wasn't until the Muslim invasion that it broke off politically. And the big issue at point there was about the nature of Christ. Does Christ have, you know, a full divine nature and a full human nature existing together, as the Orthodox position had it? Or, as many Egyptians preferred to phrase it, you did have a full divine nature and a full human nature, but they've produced together this new, fully divine and human nature of the Logos, the Word, the incarnate Word. Well, the emperors were trying to find a middle ground, a compromise position, and so they suggested, okay, let's get rid of the terminology about natures, because that's throwing everyone off. Let's just think about, you know, we'll affirm that Christ has the two natures separate, but that he only has one will. And so they're proposing this as a way of kind of getting around the objection that the Egyptian Christians had when they said, you know, talking about Jesus with two natures makes it sound like he is, you know, multiple personality disorder or something like that. And so Heraclius and some others said, well, what if we just said Jesus just has one will? So that, you know, if you can imagine when Jesus is making decisions, there's not some inner debate in his head between the divine side and the human side. It's just one will. And of course, you know, it sounds like theological nitpicking to us. But to the Christians of the time, this was serious stuff. So one of the great theologians of the time is a man called Maximus the Confessor. And he became famous because he defended the Orthodox position, which said essentially, no, we have to say that Christ had two wills, a divine will and a human will, but that the human will was always in concert, in submission to the divine will. The reason why is because, as church fathers have been saying for hundreds of years, what was not assumed by Christ cannot be redeemed by Christ. So if Jesus didn't have a real human will, then that's part of what makes us up that Jesus didn't take and didn't redeem. So Maximus said, no, you have to have both. You got to have a real human will and a real divine will. Let me, hold on here. I think I have some pictures from the study notes that I sent you. So let me bring those up. I've got, Maximus the Confessor here. I'll share the screen in just a moment. I'm just going to open a bunch of my tabs and get them all ready to go for you. Okay, hold on here. All right. Let me share my screen again. All right, now I got to find... Okay, here we go. Maximus the Confessor. You guys see him there? Mm-hmm. So that was his big deal. I think that's an important point. Like I say, it's kind of theological nitpicking to us. So I won't go too far into the ups and downs of that controversy. It was called monothelitism. That's the name of that heresy. Mono, which means one, and thelitism refers to the will, one will, monothelitism. Maximus the Confessor's real contribution, though, as a church father, is that he really synthesized a lot of the teachings and contributions of other great theologians who had come before him into this beautiful system for understanding Christian theology. And so he is one of the leading theologians in Eastern Orthodoxy. He kind of, like Augustine did for the West, Maximus the Confessor does for the East. Gives it kind of this picture of what true Christian doctrine looks like and what are the characteristic emphases of what we believe. And we'll talk about those in just a moment. But anyway, there were a couple ecumenical councils. We talked about the first four ecumenical councils at length in previous sessions. There are three other councils that are known to be ecumenical councils, but most of them really only apply to what was going on in Eastern Orthodoxy. So we won't spend a lot of time on it. Really only the first four, from Nicaea to Chalcedon, apply to us in the Western tradition. But some of the ecumenical councils, 5, 6, and 7, were concerned with monothelitism, and others were concerned with the debate over icons. And here we get another guy. Let me bring him up for you here. John of Damascus. John of Damascus is in the 8th century. You might notice here, he's got a headdress that looks kind of like an Arab sheikh headdress. You might remember, what's that old Palestinian leader? Yasser Arafat. He wore headdresses just like this. And that's because John of Damascus was an Arab. There were and are many Arab Christians in the Middle East, although unfortunately their numbers have been declining in the tumultuous times of just the past couple decades. But he was a Christian who worked at first as a politician in the Umayyad Caliphate, because that's kind of the political situation into which he was born. One of the remarkable things about the rise of Islam, not to take anything away from them, because they did produce, in terms of their literature and their science and their math, they did astonishing things, especially from the 900s on. But one of the things you should be aware of is that a lot of that cultural achievement was built on an earlier foundation of Christians within the Muslim empires, Christians like John of Damascus. It was Christian scholars who preserved the Greek philosophical works and translated them into Arabic, the Greek mathematical and scientific works and translated them into Arabic. So if it wasn't for the contribution of Christians during those first couple centuries of Islam, the flowering of Islamic civilization from the 900s on probably would have looked quite a bit different. Anyway, John of Damascus is one of those guys. He started out working in the politics of the Umayyad Caliphate, but eventually resigned and joined a monastery in Israel. So he became a monk, but he was also a theological writer. And he, like Maximus the Confessor, helped the Eastern Orthodox tradition kind of bring together all the theology that they had developed during those early centuries and put it into kind of an easily understandable form. The other thing he got involved in was the iconoclast controversy. With the rise of Islam, you suddenly have this movement on the scene that is insisting pretty strongly that you shouldn't make images, and certainly not images of God. That's something that the Muslims inherited from certain Old Testament Jewish background, but they really magnified and made it one of their main things. So images, and particularly images of God, are a big no-no in Muslim culture. Well, the Byzantines, who are suffering losses to Islam during this period, they developed a movement within the Byzantine Empire to say, you know, maybe that's something we should think about. Maybe we are experiencing some of these losses because we've been making images and, you know, using them as part of our worship, part of our veneration. Maybe God is displeased with that. And so you had this movement called iconoclasm, which means destroying the icons. Icons are a particular kind of painting in the Eastern Christian tradition. In fact, this picture and the one I showed you, Maximus Confessor, are icons. You can usually identify an icon by its style. It's usually painted without much depth, often just one character or a very simple biblical scene, and almost always has a gold background. And icons had developed in Eastern Christianity as a major part of Christian worship, and they've been used for hundreds of years in this way. So if you step into an Eastern Orthodox church today, you'll see that, I mean, it's kind of wild. It's worth doing if you've never done it before. They've got these things everywhere, all around the walls, all across the front of the church. You know, floor to ceiling is often these icons. And they do. They would say that they make an important distinction. They would say we do not worship the icons or, you know, any saint who happens to be pictured there. But they do offer veneration, which they say is kind of respect, holy affection for the saints, the angels, those who have gone before. And icons were used not just as paintings, but as kind of windows into the heavenly reality. And so they interact with the icons as if they're interacting with that saint himself, as if he's right there. So you'll see them sometimes bow towards icons, you'll see them sometimes kiss icons. These are both traditional ways that Eastern Orthodox piety is expressed. Again, they would insist they're not worshiping the icon. When they bow to an icon of Christ, they are worshiping Christ, who is represented in this icon. It's a window through which they can see Christ, and they're not worshiping the painting itself. So that's an important distinction. And I should say, one of the things I like about Eastern Orthodox churches, you know, regardless of what you might feel about the appropriateness of veneration of icons, one of the things I like is that it does give a really poignant reminder to Christians as they're gathered to worship that, hey, we are part of a body which includes the church triumphant in heaven and the angels, and Christ is truly present here in our midst. You know, that's something we believe as Baptists, but we just kind of have to imagine it in our heads. In Eastern Orthodox churches, it's like all there around them. When they go into worship, they are always reminded that they're surrounded by choirs of angels and saints, which I think is kind of neat. Anyway, John of Damascus pushed back hard against the people who wanted to destroy the icons. And he said, essentially, our use of icons is undergirded by our belief that God uses material things to express his truth and his work in the world. And that's the fundamental doctrine behind the incarnation of Christ, that God uses the material stuff of our world to communicate himself to us. That's what he did when Jesus took on flesh, a real human body, real human nature. So John of Damascus said, look, if you are condemning icons for that, then that's dangerous, because essentially you might end up condemning the idea of the incarnation itself. And you're all the way back into Gnosticism if that's what's happening. So he defended the use of icons. His position was vindicated and celebrated at the 7th Ecumenical Council, the last one, 787 AD. And that's why you'll still find icons in Eastern Orthodox churches. The other thing I'll say about Eastern Orthodoxy before we move on is that it is really defined by its piety, even more than its doctrine, I would say. If you talk to Eastern Orthodox and want to know kind of what are the distinctive things you believe, how do I understand Eastern Orthodoxy and the way you think about Christianity, you know, they might be able to talk about some of their doctrines, but much more likely they'll say, well, you got to come to worship, and you got to pray with us. They really sincerely hold that Christianity is experienced with your whole self, which again is something that I like. It gets us out of our Western sort of intellect-only mentality, where we feel like, okay, I've got this checklist of doctrines I need to say yes to in my mind. The Eastern Orthodox really emphasize the important place of Christian practice as well as Christian belief. And so they continue to use a liturgy that was, you know, in large part written by John Chrysostom back at the turn of the 400s AD. Still use it today. You walk into any Eastern Orthodox church, you're going to be worshiping in almost the exact form that Christians were worshiping back in the 500s and 600s AD. They still use the same exact church service. They've added a few hymns over the years, but still the same form. In fact, when I was in college, I went on kind of a field trip with some friends to an Eastern Orthodox church, and we talked to one of their Sunday school teachers afterwards. And he said to us, he said, you know, we don't deny that the Holy Spirit may well work through the kinds of worship that you folks offer. But he said, for us who are Eastern Orthodox, we know that the Holy Spirit works through this liturgy that we've been using for 1,500 years. So we're going to keep using it. So, and I said, you know, that's fair enough. but really a focus on prayer. Prayer as participation in communion with God in a way that transforms us is a really big part of the Eastern Orthodox tradition. So us up there with Eastern Orthodoxy, but that just gives you kind of an initial taste. It's still part of global Christianity during this time period. It hasn't broken away from the Roman Catholic Church, but it's already starting to take on its own distinctive culture. Let's move on now to starting on early Christian missions. I'll do a few of these, and then we'll take a little break here as we hit the halfway point of our time together. But we're going to begin with just a couple one. And since we're talking about Eastern Christianity, I'll stick with the Church of the East. There's an interesting figure of one of their early leaders, Babai the Great. The Church of the East, if you remember, is the one that had been planted out in Persia and Mesopotamia earlier on in church history. When Nestorius was expelled from the Roman Empire, many of his followers went and joined with the Christians in Persia. And so it's sometimes called in sources the Nestorian Church, but they call themselves the Church of the East. So that's what I'm going to call them. The Church of the East was one of the most remarkable mission movements in the history of Christianity. And this particular story has been much neglected in church histories. It's only really within the past 10 or 15 years that taking a course on church history like you guys are doing now would include some of this. We're kind of rediscovering the importance of the story of the Church of the East. One of the phenomenal things they did is plant churches all across Asia. Asia is massive, obviously the largest continent on earth, but it's also historically proven really difficult for Christian missions and evangelism in our age. Back here, though, look at how vast the scope was of Christian expansion under the Church of the East. They just had developed this missional culture of sending people out in a way that, frankly, Christians in the Roman Empire didn't. Christians in the Roman Empire obviously were pretty effective at spreading the faith within their own local communities, but in terms of sending out missionaries, that's not really something that Roman Christians ever even thought to do. But the Church of the East did, and you see the results here. Look at this. So this is all within the first millennium AD. They've got churches planted in Mesopotamia, in Persia. You've got some of the Thomas churches down here in India already. And then you notice they're expanding into Central Asia, in what's now Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan and all the way up here into Mongolia. You have Christians that press through Tibet and plant churches on the east coast of China. And this was all done before the year 1000, which is just astonishing, because, you know, we Eurocentric Christians tend to think that, well, Christianity didn't get around that part of the world until European missionaries started taking it there in the 1700s, 1800s. No, the Church of the East had a footprint a lot earlier on. It lasted for a few hundred years. Unfortunately, it didn't last all the way through until today. There are no native Chinese Christians that still trace their roots to the Church of the East, although the Chinese church now is very strong. But for several hundred years, you had Christian presence in all these places, which I just think is remarkable. This kind of pagoda-like building that I passed over here, that's an ancient Church of the East monument that had been built in China back in the 700s, I think, 700s, 800s. And then here, I've got a picture of a Chinese tablet, an ancient Chinese monument, which describes the gospel message as brought to China by Church of the East missionaries. They brought it all the way to the Chinese emperor's court, explained the gospel to him, and got his permission to evangelize. And so they did. Just kind of a remarkable growth. In fact, you know, you've heard stories of Genghis Khan and the Mongol hordes from the like the 1200s. We'll touch on them a little bit in the next session with the Middle Ages. What most people don't know is that, you know, these weren't just, you know, barbarians, pagan barbarians from the hinterlands, there were actually Christians in Genghis Khan's own court when he started launching his territorial expansion, because you had a Church of the East presence up here in this area. So, really fascinating story there. During this time, you also have, and actually somewhat earlier, you also have the evangelization of Ethiopia. Ethiopia isn't marked on this map, but it's down here in the Horn of Africa, and it's one of the oldest Christian civilizations in the world. According to the story, it was during the 300s that a couple Christian guys who were sailing on a ship, the Red Sea was a major trade route back in that day. They were sailing on a ship and they got shipwrecked here on the coast of Ethiopia. Frumentius was the name of one of them. And Frumentius, while he was there, started preaching the gospel. And he eventually got permission from our old friend Athanasius up here in Egypt, Alexandria. He got permission from Athanasius to organize the church. So Frumentius became a bishop, organized a church in Ethiopia. And even today, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church is the majority Christian church in Ethiopia. It's part of the communion of churches we call Oriental Orthodox, like the Coptic Church in Egypt. But still, really profound Christian presence there today. You may have seen them, they're famous for a couple things. They're famous for believing that they have the actual Ark of the Covenant, and they have parades with a replica that they made. The actual ark, or what they call the actual ark, is never brought out. No one publicly gets to see that. They also have some of the most interesting church buildings in the world. They have these beautiful churches in a place called Lalibela, which are cut out of rock. There was this massive rock face on the ground, and to create their churches, they cut down into this rock face and carved out a church from a single piece of stone. So these stone churches that sit in this courtyard that they've carved out into this massive rock. Really interesting. If you get a chance, look those up because the pictures are pretty cool. The churches of Lalibela.